Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast Producer of the Month is Steve Corey. Thank you, Steve. Be just like Steve and get rewarded for supporting our podcast. Head over to patreon.com/Gilbert Gottfried.
Go to patreon.com/Gilbert Gottfried. That's Patreon, patreon.com/Gilbert Gottfried. As always, thank you for your generosity.
This is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Frank Santopadre, and our guest this week is a celebrated film and TV director, producer, and editor, and one of the first names we wrote down when we decided to put together this podcast. His long list of credits include The Howling, Innerspace, Gremlins, The Burbs, Twilight Zone, The Movie, and one of our favorites, Matinee. In his long career, he's worked with dozens of legendary performers, many of whom we love to talk about on this show, including Kevin McCarthy, John Carradine, and Christopher Lee, to name a few. His terrific website is called Trailers from Hell and features hundreds of commentaries on classic and not-so-classic movie trailers. Please welcome one of the few people walking the earth who is as obsessed with old horror and sci-fi films as I am. Joe Dante.
Why, I'm humbled.
We're humbled, Joe. Thanks for doing this.
And we've had on the show at least two people we think you're familiar with. Just a few days ago, we spoke to Bruce Dern.
I love Bruce. Bruce can tell you what Jesse Lasky had for breakfast.
That's amazing.
Everybody, I noticed it, and everybody comments on Bruce Dern's amazing memory.
He seems to remember things that happened before he was born, let alone before he was in the movies.
Yeah, he was our first guest to ask us trivia questions.
Well, he's a fabulous guy. I mean, yeah. he's so much fun to have on the set. On the Burbs, he was like the organizing group. He would do football pools. He would do trivia contests. He's just one of the most fun people to be around that I ever worked with.
And we also interviewed someone who is more obsessed with saving money than I am. And that's
saying a lot.
Roger Corman.
Well, he's not as much fun as Bruce, of course. But
no,
I'm kidding. If it wasn't for Roger, I wouldn't be talking to you today.
Yeah, he's a raconteur. He told us some wonderful stories, and of course, the one about the tennis game being rained out. A story I've heard you tell.
No, it's a great story, and Roger has again. You're talking about somebody who, if they had not existed, the firmament of the movie business as we know it today would not exist, because everybody in the 70s who got anywhere were people who started with Roger, and they transformed the entire business.
Yeah, I mean, it was Francis Ford Coppola.
Bogdanovich.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, so many people. Yeah, Ron Howard.
Martin Scorsese. I mean, all these great people. And Roger's secret was that he really could – the idea was when you worked for Roger, it was because – you know, you couldn't work anywhere else because it was all non-union and you didn't know anything. And so Roger would hire people, and he had a great talent for discovering who really cared about the movie and who would work extra hard to make their Women in Cages movie the best Women in Cages movie. and would work on Sunday. And then Roger would often say, well, nobody works for me on Sunday. Well, we all worked for him on Sunday, because if we cared, we wanted to do the best job possible. And under the circumstances, which were rather dire, he would throw every obstacle in your path that you could imagine, and yet you would still manage to come out with a movie. And that's why all those people who went through the Corman School, as we called it, ended up being, fairly prominent in the business, because they really learned their craft.
And do you remember any stories about, like, the craziest ways he would save money?
Well, one of the things he would like to say was sit down a lot. He'd take all the directors out before they shot, and then he would give them advice. And one of them would be sit down a lot because it's difficult. And then, of course, there were no chairs, so there was nothing place to sit. And then the other thing, which I actually ended up using, which everybody thought was apocryphal, but actually was true, was that you can indeed shoot night scenes by your car headlights. And on the Howling, we had a generator failure, and we were going to have to shut down for the day. And I remembered that Roger had said you could shoot scenes by the light of your car headlights. And so we put all the crew cars together, and we turned the headlights on, and we kept shooting.
That's great.
Now, you, I think, came to fame with the movie Piranha.
Yes.
And that was a movie, if I remember the plot correctly. It was about these creatures who live underwater with powerful jaws, and they're eating the swimmers, and no one wants to tell anyone about it because it's a vacation community. And Universal Studios said, in their legal terms, this is a fucking ripoff of Jaws.
Well, I don't know if I would use the word fucking. But I think it was fairly apparent to all of us,
yes,
that it was indeed a ripoff of Jaws. And they didn't really get involved with it, except for the fact that they had a sequel coming up for Jaws, Jaws 2. And that was why they wanted to protect their franchise. And there were a number of other pictures. There was a picture, there was a couple of shark pictures from Mexico that they managed to get injunctions against and keep off the market.
Wasn't there one called Great White?
This one they tried. They tried to actually keep it off the market. And to my everlasting gratitude, Steven Spielberg saw the movie and said, no, you guys don't understand. It's a spoof. It's a parody of Jaws. It's not a ripoff. Well, that was very kind of him, because it really was a ripoff. But I tried to turn it into sort of a parody. And it was, it was the movie that put me on the map, because it actually made quite a bit of money, particularly considering how little it cost.
And from then on, you and Steven Spielberg worked a lot together.
Yes, he had. It turned out he had seen Piranha, and I had no idea that he had been instrumental in getting the picture released and not injuncted. But then he apparently had seen The Howling, which is a picture I did after Piranha. And he liked the performance of Dee Wallace, who was the lead in that picture, and he put her in E.T. And then when it came time for him to start his own company, Amblin, which was initially conceived as a low-budget film company, he wanted to do a low-budget horror film, and he came to me because I had done them before, and he asked me to do a picture that eventually turned out to be Gremlins.
Take us back a couple of steps, Joe, before you made Piranha. I mean, how'd you get hooked up with Roger Corman in the first place? You started as an editor with him?
Well, my friend John Davison, who I had met in Philadelphia, had come out here to be the head of publicity for New World Pictures, which is the company that Roger was running at the time. And they needed a trailer editor because Roger was annoyed that he kept bringing people in and trying to explain to them how the trailers were made, and then he would have to explain to the new guy how the trailers were made. And so they decided they'd make a trailer department. And so they brought me out, and I started to make some trailers for pictures like Candy Stripe Nurses and Caged Heat, which was Jonathan Demme's first.
Yeah, we know that.
Both those pictures made money. And so it was like, well, the trailers must have had something to do with it. Let's keep this guy. And then Alan Arkush came out, was also an NYU buddy of John's, came out, and we became the trailer department for New World Pictures, and we would make all the trailers for the movies. And some of the movies were, you know, better than others, and some of them weren't really very good at all. But we had to, we learned while making trailers that you can take a scene that runs 4 minutes and you can condense it into 30 seconds by just taking the best parts of it. And so when it came, we started to think, well, maybe we could make a movie. And so we asked Roger if we could make a picture, and he said it was okay as long as it's the cheapest movie they'd ever made there. And we all had 10 days, and we had to keep making trailers at night. So we couldn't figure out how to make a releasable movie under those circumstances until we figured out that if we made a picture that was conceived around the footage that we'd been using in the trailers for other pictures, we could make a movie. And Roger was doing these three girl movies at the time. There were teachers and nurses, and they would like have adventures and take their clothes off and have left-wing, vaguely left-wing adventures. And we said, well, let's do starlets. Let's do actresses. And then the movies that the actresses are in, all the scenes that they're in that we could take from other movies that we've been working on. So we made this picture called Hollywood Boulevard, about these three girls who come to Hollywood and make these movies, which largely consist of scenes from other movies that already existed. Mm-hmm. And we did it in 10 days. And Alan and I co-directed the movie. He would call cut, and I would call action. And then he would set up the next scene, and I would call cut, and he would shoot his scene, and then he'd be finished. And then I'd call action, I'd shoot my scene. And we managed to get the whole movie made in 10 days. And, you know, it was a pretty arcane movie. It's now kind of a cult following. But at the time, it was didn't exactly set the world on fire.
With Paul Bartel and his wife from Eating Raoul fame. Yeah.
Were in it, who had, you know, they both, Paul made Death Race, which Mario was in. And the Candace Rowson, who was the reigning B-movie queen at the time, was the star. And it's a pretty silly movie, but it's a fairly decent picture of actually the way things worked at New World Pictures in the 1970s.
And you did the movie Gremlins. Now, Gremlins set off a bunch of ripoff movies, like Ghoulies and Trolls.
We don't call them ripoffs. We call them homages. You know, there was Critters.
Oh yeah, Critters.
Which was one of the best, probably the best ones of those, because they were done by the Chiodo brothers, who are like really clever. And,
oh, I worked with them.
Those are the killer clowns from outer space, guys.
Yeah, those guys are out there. Yeah.
I worked with them and Howie Mandel in Adventures of the Amazing Sea Monkeys.
Really?
Yes.
There you go.
It must have been in between Gizmo gigs for him.
Oh yes.
And then there was, of course, Ghoulies.
Oh, yes.
It was Charles Band's version.
Now, which one had Sonny Bono?
I think Ghoulies.
That sounds safe.
And then there was another one called Munchies.
Oh, that's right!
Which was actually made by Roger, and it was directed by Tina Hirsch, who edited Gremlins. And the thing about Munchies was... And Harvey Korman was in it. And so, you know, it had its moments. But the thing about the Munchies were they didn't want to have animatronics, and they didn't want to have dolls. So basically the monsters were played by these clothing remnants that looked kind of like dolls, and then we just sort of throw them around in the frame. Not a particularly good movie.
So Roger wound up making a film that was an homage to one of your films.
An homage, yes.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. I love how you said...
You're picking up on the terminology.
I love how you said they expected, talking about Corman and working for Corman, how they expected the movies at New World to be bad.
So well, that was the great thing about working for Roger, was that you know, the industry, such as it was, and any kind of notice that it took of these movies, which was not very much, was that if the movie wasn't terrible, maybe you were talented, and maybe you'd be worth, you know, bringing on to some, you know, studio kind of a movie, or at least a more expensive, low-budget movie. And that was one of the keys of working for Roger. As he often said, if you're good and you work for me, you won't have to work for me more than twice.
Right.
And another unseen star of Gremlins who we've had on the show, Howie Mandel.
Yep.
Well, Howie was unseen because he, you know, was just doing voices. But Howie was one of the keys to the success of the movie, because at the time he had this sort of baby character that he was doing voices with. He sort of brought that childishness to this Gizmo character who didn't really have a lot of dialogue in the sense that you could understand it. But there was a sort of a glossary of things that he would say, and he would imitate things that people would say. And Howie would do it in this baby voice that was just revoltingly cute. And I think it's one of the reasons, along with the design of the character, which is based on one of Steven Spielberg's dogs, because he kept not approving the design, and we finally said, well, let's make it the same color as his dogs and maybe he'll approve it. And when Howie came along, I mean, he really made this thing into a character.
And I actually like the sequel better.
Yeah, Gremlins 2 is fun.
Well,
they're both fun.
It's a closely guarded secret, but I prefer the sequel as well.
Yeah, because there you just went all out.
Yeah, it's wilder.
Yeah, totally.
Well, they were desperate for a sequel, and they had tried, apparently, over a number of years. They came to me right after the first movie, and they said, let's make a sequel right away. And I was so exhausted. It was such a difficult movie to make because we were inventing the technology. And no one really believed in it at the time. And so it was, you know, it was a great vindication that it became a big hit. But they came back and they said, let's make another one. I said, no, I can't do it. I'm done. And so they worked on it for 5 years trying to figure out a reason to make the sequel. But since they didn't really quite get the first movie, I mean, they were happy that it was successful, but they didn't really understand what the appeal was. They finally came back to me and Mike Fennell, the producer, and they said, well, if you guys will make a sequel for us, you can do whatever you want. And that's, you don't get that kind of offer very often. And so we said, well, let's make a sequel that's about sequels and about how this movie doesn't really need one.
Very smart.
And you know, we have this character played by John Glover, who is a combination of Donald Trump and Ted Turner, mm-hmm. Who started out as the villain. But then as the movie progressed, John played it so likably that he ended up being kind of a pseudo hero. And I can only look back at the current political situation and regret that decision.
And I remember Tony Randall was in it.
Yes, Tony Randall was the voice of the brain gremlin. And one of the best days of my life in the movie business was in a New York recording studio working with Tony Randall to do this voice, which he sort of based on George Plimpton.
Oh, interesting.
And, wow. And he was just so hilarious and so funny and so witty. And he came up with so much stuff. I mean, a lot of the stuff that's in the movie wasn't scripted. I mean, it's just stuff that he came up with. And there was this design that didn't exist when we made the first film, which is now completely obsolete, of course, but it was called the Gilder Fluke. And what it was it allowed the puppet to move its lips to a pre-recorded track. And so Tony's tracks would be edited and then they would be played back on set and the characters would move their lips and look like they were actually speaking. And it was one of the best aspects of that movie. I mean, it's just so much fun. And today, of course, everything will be CGI. And it'll be
right, of course.
And I remember he had a little bit of George Sanders mm-hmm. in the character, too.
Yeah, a very supercilious attitude.
And one funny part is in the original, Phoebe Cates does that whole story about her father dresses up as Santa Claus mm-hmm. and he falls down the chimney and dies. And then they had to redo it in the second one as I think it was Lincoln's birthday.
Well, you know, that was a very controversial aspect of the first movie with the studio because they really didn't understand what was funny about that scene. And they kept wanting to cut it out. And I said, no, I think this really sort of encapsulates the whole movie because it's funny. But if it happened to you, it's not funny, you know. And so we had to fight about keeping it in the movie. And we had this great preview, and everybody thought it was wonderful, and the studio was thrilled. And they said, all we have to do is cut out that one speech by Phoebe Cates, and then the picture will be perfect. And I appealed to Steven Spielberg. I said, Lee, I really think I like this scene. I think it's really important, and it's the only character moment she's got in the movie. And he, you know, because he was filmmaker friendly, as Amblin was, he said, okay. And the studio was grumbled, but they went, okay. And the picture went out and made a lot of money anyway. So when we made the sequel, I couldn't resist doing a riff on that scene.
I like the casting of that of Gremlins very much, too, Joe. What can you tell us about Key Luke or Hoyt Axton or both of them?
Well, for Hoyt Axton's part, we saw all these actors. I mean, we saw everybody in town, we saw great actors. We saw Pat Hingle.
Oh, love him!
And did such a reading of this failed inventor that it was as if William Saroyan had written it, and it was like we can't hire him. It's too real. It's too emotional. And the same thing with Polly Holiday's character. I mean, there were moments in the movie where she played Mrs. Deagle as so sympathetically that we had to cut the scene out. because it was more of a cartoony movie than that.
She's great in the film, though.
She is wonderful in the film, and it was wonderful to work with. But they all were, and Hoyt was, you know, he was a great guy, and I had particularly been impressed with him in The Black Stallion. You know, of course, I knew his music and everything.
Sure,
but,
we should remind our listeners that he was a songwriter. He wrote "Joy to the World,"
absolutely,
a very big song, and never been to Spain.
He would serenade the crew at lunch.
Yep.
With his
Renaissance man.
With his bony fingers, you know, guitar thing. He was a great guy to have around. And it was just one of those lucky things where, look, the elements fit together. It's the right movie at the right time. If it had come out a year earlier, a year later, 7 months earlier, who knows? I mean, but the particular time it came out, it was the movie that the zeitgeist wanted to see.
Mm-hmm. And you use a lot. The old star, well, old supporting actor, Dick Miller.
Oh, we love Dick Miller.
Well, I started out as a movie fan before I was a movie maker. And I, you know, grew up watching a lot of these people. And for me to have a Dick Miller, I had Dick in my first movie because I thought, it's my first movie. It may be my only movie. I want to put Dick in it. And because I had always enjoyed watching him. And, of course, we became friends and he became sort of an avatar for me, and he was in almost every movie I ever did. But then there were other actors that I worked with, like Kevin McCarthy and Bill Shallard and Scott Brady, and people that I had seen growing up that I always liked. And mm-hmm. I remember the meeting I had with Scott Brady for the sheriff in Gremlins. He said, Mike Fennell and I said, well, you know, we went over how much we enjoyed this performance and that performance or whatever. And I guess this guy was so used to going into meetings with people who didn't know who he was that he said, I don't care what the part is, I'll do it.
Wow.
And that was true with Gail Gordon as well.
Oh, yes, Gail Gordon in The Burbs.
Yes, he said, no, fine. I don't care what, I don't need to read it, I'll do it. Because, you know, during that period, there were people who were filmmakers, and there were people who were just making films, and they weren't necessarily that invested in film history. Mm-hmm. And so they really, when somebody said, well, why don't you see this actor? They really weren't that familiar with their, you know, previous work. And, you know, since I grew up watching all these people, I was thrilled to meet people. I was supposed to do a movie called The Phantom, which ended up getting made by somebody else. But I remember interviewing Rod Steiger for a part. And, I'd always been very impressed with Rod Steiger. And he practically begged us for the part because his career had not been going well. And it was just a very interesting position to be in.
For a kid from Morristown, New Jersey, who's going to revival theaters and watching these people, and here you are, and it's not that many years later, you're auditioning them for your movies.
Absolutely,
it had to be an out of body experience.
It's true. You know, I mean, you get people that you thought you would never even get to meet, let alone work with.
Right.
And then when you did get to work with them, I mean, of course, the majority of them, I can't think of an actor who disappointed me in the sense that, well, he's an asshole. You know, I mean, I just never encountered any of those.
And at the Rod Steiger story brings me back to a story that Rod Steiger said later in his life. He was meeting with a producer. He was up for a movie, and the producer said to him, well, this is a Southern character. Can you do a Southern accent?
Oi. Didn't know their history.
How old is in the heat of the night by then, you know?
Yeah. And I think Steiger said, well, I won an Academy Award for my Southern accent. And the producer said, well, do you have a copy of this film?
Well, look, I mean, that gets into a whole different area of discussion, which is, you know, film history. And we live in a time when there are more movies available, if you care to look for them, than have ever been available in my lifetime. And when I was a kid, you know, you went to the movies. If you saw a movie you liked, you would wait 5 years and maybe you'd see it on TV. And if you missed that TV showing, you'd have to wait another year and a half before another TV showing. I mean, that was just the way things worked. Now, there's so many things available to see that have been restored or, you know, on the digital or whatever. But yet, the majority of people are completely unfamiliar with anything that was made before 1990.
I remember when I was a kid, I would check the local listings of Route 66 every day to see if they'd be showing, I think it was Lizard's Tail and Owlet's Wing.
I'm sure Joe's familiar with it.
Boris Karloff, Chaney Jr., and Peter Lorre.
Right.
And the one day I didn't check the listing that was on.
And you wanted to kill yourself.
Yes.
Right.
Well, but, you know, when I was a kid, TV Guide was your Bible.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I mean, that was – they had a listing of movies in the front, and it was like what movies are going to run this week and where. And that was like, okay, that was the only place you could go to find that stuff out. Now, of course, you know, there's with Wikipedia and IMDb, I mean, there's all this information available and all sorts of discussions about movies that you could never have because, you know, as a kid – you didn't even know if there were people who really liked the kind of stuff that you liked. And it really took the emergence of Famous Monsters of Film Land in 1958 for kids to realize that there were other kids, geeky kids, out there like themselves.
From you know, Famous
oh my God, there's other kids who like these movies.
From Famous Monsters of Film Land, I have a few feet from me in my house a poster of Frankenstein. That 6-foot poster they used to sell.
In the back.
In the back.
Right.
The Captain Company.
And I ordered one of these in the ads. They called it Herman the Asiatic Insect. And you'd see some enormous insect with fangs and claws and hair. And I ordered it and it came in like a little like the size of a matchbox and it was a stick with some fur glued on it and rubber bands for antennas.
But that was the whole secret of all those comic book ads. You know, thousands of soldiers, you know, and you buy them, and it turns out they're so skinny. Yeah. You turn them sideways, they're like the size of they're like razor blades. I mean, there's like nothing there.
And there was one called Surprise Package. Do you remember this one?
Oh.
With just the question marks around it. You didn't even know what you were going to get.
How about X-ray specs?
X-ray specs.
Oh, yeah. Yes. For every horny kid out there. Because you'd see that dorky kid would be staring at a girl and seeing her naked body underneath it. So, of course, every boy wanted those.
Right. Johnson Smith, wasn't that the name of the catalog?
Johnson Smith catalog.
Yeah, yeah, that sold all that stuff.
Wait, are we old?
Wow. Yeah, we are.
Oh, and you used to be able, and this was the most crooked thing ever. You used to be able to order monkeys by
sea
mail
monkeys.
Order.
No, sea monkeys.
No, real monkeys.
Where did you order real monkeys?
Real monkeys. And it was
real monkeys.
It was totally black market shit. And
I don't know where you were.
They
looking.
Would send you. They would. You would get a monkey. I thank God I never ordered it.
Are you serious? But I'm a person who ever got a monkey.
The monkeys God. when the kids received them, the monkeys were either dying or dead.
Are you serious?
I swear to God,
horrible.
There were monkeys you could buy by mail.
Oh, God.
It was the most total black market.
You learned something every day, Joe.
Midgets in suits. They weren't.
Midgets in suits. Since, and by the way, since we brought up Famous Monsters of Filmland, you wrote for Famous Monsters of Filmland at one point, Joe.
To validate your existence, you had to get your name in Famous Monsters. And as a letter, you'd write a letter, and if it got published, you were like a celebrity. So I wrote all these letters. I wrote the best movies I'd ever seen, the scariest movies I'd ever seen, and finally I wrote the worst movies I'd ever seen. And that one got turned into an article, even though I hadn't seen like about 15 of the movies.
Well, that counts.
And
you wrote
but
for
I became a celebrity.
You wrote for Castle of Frankenstein, another film magazine.
Castle of Frankenstein was the magazine that was for people who were too old for Famous Monsters.
Okay.
I remember.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Our crack research team.
Look out, Joe. He's got a cell phone.
Found an ad here. Man's account of ordering a live monkey from a comic book ad. And it's a drawing of a monkey, America's most amusing pet, the squirrel monkey. Good, healthy.
How could the FDA allow this? I mean, it's...
Oh, you could get away with all this shit back then. Oh, and you could get it for just $13.95. A live monkey.
Shipped it in a box? I mean,
yeah, probably with no holes in it to breathe.
Incredible.
I'll bet John Landis ordered one. He loves monkeys.
And talking about your childhood, since we're talking about it, Joe, and Gilbert's childhood, you're a local kid. You're from New Jersey.
Jersey.
And I thought, doing research about you, it was very touching, your story about going, your dad. I mean, your dad was a golf pro. He was on the road a lot. Him taking you to see Tarantula, I thought that was such a sweet story.
Well, you know, I the movie theater, the local movie theater used to play movies Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, Sunday. So on Thursday, the movie is over. And like I saw the trailer for Tarantula and I really wanted to see it. And my father, I begged him to take me, and he was, you know, he got up really early and he came back really late and he took me to see the movie. And I was so scared that I hung out in the lobby. I was pacing in the lobby. I remember the manager like laughing at me and elbowing the cashier saying, "Look at this kid, he can't take it." Leaving my father alone to watch a giant spider movie by himself.
Now, I remember, like, Tarantula is, to use your words, Joe, an homage to the movie Them.
Yes, indeed. Right, yeah, but right. It's the best homage.
And
all the ones that followed were worse.
The funny thing is, Them is the respected film, and I like Tarantula better.
Well, Them is a better movie.
Is that the one with James Whitmore?
Yeah.
Them, yeah.
I
yes,
mean, that's
really,
good. That's really a really good movie. It's good. I mean, it's really well written, and it's really well paced, and it's and I must add that I had seen Them, of course, and I had nightmares for years. Because the sounds of the ants sounded somewhat like crickets. And, of course, we had crickets in the backyard of my house. And Them takes place in the desert. And the back of my house was – there was a development that had been raised, and it was full of concrete and it sort of sticking up out of the ground, and it looked kind of like a desert. And then in the wind, the leaves – the branches of the trees would scratch against my windows, and it was like giant ant antennas. And my parents would say, "Why do you see these movies when they make you have nightmares?" And my only answer was, "I can't help it. I just love these movies. I love being scared, and that's why I ended up making so many horror movies."
That's great. It's a good story.
And. Because I remember Tarantula is the one with Leo J. Carroll.
Right.
Leo G. Carroll.
Yeah, yep.
And that's
the reason I wanted to see it, because he was on Topper, which was a TV show that
yes.
was
that's right.
very popular at the time.
Wasn't he on
and
it?
And he was actually one of Hitchcock's favorite actors.
I remember him being in It Takes a Thief with Robert Wagner? Was he in that show?
Probably.
Leo G. Carroll?
He's the man from Uncle.
Oh, the man from Uncle.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
That's
right.
That's right.
That's right.
Right.
He was the head of the
yeah.
organization.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
And I remember in Tarantula, it's all based on finding a cure for, as they called it, acromegalia.
Which is actually acromegaly.
I know.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about it on the show a lot.
It was based on a science fiction theater episode about called No Food for Thought, which was about creating artificial nutrients. And that's the backbone of the basic story of Tarantula, which is that in creating the artificial nutrients, they create giantism, and they have giant, you know, guinea pigs and giant rats and this giant spider, which was, you know, it was scary when it was 50 feet tall, but it was a lot scarier when I was a kid when it was only 3 feet tall and it was under my bed.
If you don't think you have the money to start your own business, then I have fantastic news. Now you can own a business that has been proven to be a phenomenal success all around the country with very little upfront investment. We're talking Selfie Station. I love this company. Selfie Station is a portable touchscreen photo booth that people and businesses book for weddings, corporate functions, trade shows, proms, promotional events, and more. Once you own one, they are the hit at every holiday party, bar mitzvah, or birthday. You can make your money back in no time. It's more than just a photo booth. It's the entertainment as well. Selfie Station, interactive experience that captures lifelong memories, can be emailed, text, printed, personalized, and even uploaded to social media. You won't believe how much people will pay you to make your business the life of their party. It's the easiest income you'll ever earn, and it pays for itself in no time at all. You can start your own business right now. Let Selfie Station be the picture taker, icebreaker, and your money maker. Now, as a special introductory offer, I always screw that word up. You know, if they had a real announcer, he would know how to say introductory. Now, as a special introductory offer, get $500 off the professional package. That's right, $500 off. Go to SelfieStationPodcast.com and support our show by entering promo code Gilbert. That's SelfieStationPodcast.com, promo code Gilbert. Speaking of big, the guy, the king of the big films, who we named our show after, and that's Bert I. Gordon.
Yeah, we were just talking about him.
Mr. Big.
Yes, and he was just always making things larger for his movies. Lizards, bugs, right. Everything.
And yeah, I don't think he did any small things. He didn't do any Incredible Shrinking Man kind of things. That's Jack Arnold.
Yeah, and he's still with us, Bert Gordon, in his 90s.
Bert is still around, and he is still working.
Yeah, we're
go on IMDb. He's got a picture.
We're going to pursue him for this show if it kills us.
I think it's a great idea. He's not particularly loquacious.
Oh, okay.
And
we'll do a short one.
One person Frank and I would have loved to have had on the podcast, and that's Sammy Petrillo.
Oh, yeah. Well, we discovered the website, Joe, and we're absolutely in love with it, with Trailers from Hell. And the first one that we saw was Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla.
Well, I remember seeing that picture when I was a kid on TV under the title Boys from Brooklyn, and I was a huge Ben Lewis fan. And as a 7-year-old or 8-year-old or however I was, I thought, is this really a Martin and Lewis movie that I never heard of? Because they actually were a pretty good approximation of Martin and Lewis.
Yeah. Well, same
Petrillo more than Dookie Mitchell.
Yeah.
Petrillo
was like an exact replica.
Well, Jerry had hired him apparently as to play Baby Jerry on an episode of the Colgate Comedy Hour. And I guess Sammy figured, this is a pretty good gig. And he, continued to play Jerry, much apparently to Jerry's distress.
Yeah. And I heard that, I think Hal Wallace, who produced the Martin and Lewis movies, at first wanted to get a lawsuit to stop Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. But when he saw clips of it and he saw how terrible it was, he thought it's not even worth it.
Well, it didn't exactly, set the guys on a large career trajectory,
No. My dad knew Dookie Mitchell growing up in Brooklyn. Not for nothing, as they used to say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't have a big career either.
No, but Sammy persisted for many years, apparently doing a variation of that act.
Yeah, it's a strange film.
It's very creepy. It's like you feel like you are watching a Martin and Lewis movie, but it's a Martin and Lewis nightmare.
Yeah, no, it's an alternate world, bizarro world.
Yes, yes.
Is this one time we don't have to use the word homage?
Yeah.
I think so.
Now, you were going to do a Jaws 3.
Oh, Jaws 3, people, nothing. Yeah.
I was supposed to do, after I did Piranha, I got a lot of offers for aquatic movies. a lot of barracuda kind of movies, and I work with Dino De Laurentiis briefly on an Orca 2.
Oh, wow.
And
yes.
Dino said, Orca, he's a coma crazy, he's a kill everybody. that was
great.
Orca was going to go on land and kill people and leave seaweed at the crime scene. This actually didn't strike me as a particularly viable idea. I managed to talk him out of it.
So the whale, was the whale going to walk on land?
He's going crazy. He's a hooker. So then I got offered Jaws 3. by the National Lampoon, by Maddie Simmons, who was running the National Lampoon, and in conjunction with the Zanuck and Brown people who had done Jaws 2. And John Hughes, the late John Hughes, was one of the writers of the script. And the idea was that it was going to be a comedy version of Jaws. The problem was that the National Lampoon people wanted to make an R-rated version, and the Universal people wanted to make a PG. And so they couldn't really decide on the tone of the movie. And we got fairly far with it. I mean, we had Bo Derek was hired to star, or at least we talked to her about it. And the problem became that there was just so much tension involved in the two different approaches that the movie ultimately never got made, and which was lucky for me because I was able to bail out and do The Howling, on which I replaced somebody who was supposed to do a different version of The Howling. And it, I think Jaws 3 People Zero probably, under the circumstances I was dealing with, wouldn't have been a very good movie.
I think the script is available online.
I'm not sure which script that is.
Oh, okay. I'm curious. I've never read it. I'm curious. I'm
sitting at my desk cutting up with the scissors different versions of the script and pasting them together. So I'm not sure which version.
Now, with The Howling, I heard they had originally started work on American Werewolf in London, and Rick Baker was devising all the transformation scenes. And Rob Bottin was an apprentice.
Well, that's true. Rob was Rick's apprentice, and Rob had worked with me on Piranha. And we went to Rick when The Howling came about, and Rick had been intending to do John Landis's movie, The American Werewolf in London, but the financing never came together. So Rick said, well, okay, you know, I mean, you know, if John's movie isn't going to happen, I'll do yours. And magically, as soon as Rick said he would do ours and John found out about it, suddenly PolyGram came up with some money and John was making his movie. And Rick said, I really promised John I have to do his movie. But and he had done some tests for us that were really pretty remarkable. But I'm going to leave it in the hands of Rob. And so you guys make your movie and we'll make our movie. And I think we made our movie first, and I think we were finished first, but John's movie was much more expensive than was a studio picture and came out a little later.
Howling's a lot of fun.
It is, because Howling's one of those movies that it's like not a comedy, but certainly filled with laughs, like sick laughs.
Oh, and wonderful in jokes.
Well, it was a movie supposedly for people who like werewolf movies. And I figured I might not ever get to make another one. And so I wanted to put all of my werewolf lore interest into this one movie. And, it was made for a small company called Avico Embassy, which at the time was making pictures like Scanners. And we're having some success with it. It became a surprise hit, even though it was a pretty low-budget movie.
I remember one scene where they're in someone's office, and on the desk is a little framed portrait of Lon Chaney Jr.
And it was Rob Bottin's original picture of Lon Chaney Jr., who was like 17 or 18 in the picture. We just felt that, you know, we needed to make all the homages that we could get away with in this picture. And also the trick was that, you know, at the time, werewolf movies were considered kind of corny because there hadn't been really very many successful ones lately. And everybody associated them with The Late Late Show. And so we sold it as a slasher movie. We kept the supernatural elements out of the ad campaign and even out of the movie until the first half hour's over, so that the audience would be gradually, supposedly, you know, dragged in to believing in what is always a problem in horror movies, which is the suspension of disbelief.
I love that you named so many characters after the directors of werewolf movies too. That was a wonderful
joke. That was my idea. I wanted to call all the characters after the directors of werewolf movies, except for John Sayles, the writer. He was a big baseball fan, so all the characters who aren't named after werewolf directors are named after baseball players.
I love that.
And there's one scene where Dee Wallace Stone has to meet a guy in a porno theater. And I think they said Dee Wallace Stone was very afraid of going into a porno theater.
Well, she was, she was and is a very sensitive person. And when we the porno booth scene was shot on a stage, but the porno place was actually on Western Avenue, and it was a real porno store. And her, the discomfort that you see on screen of her walking into this store and looking at the covers of these magazines is real. that is not acting. That is her.
And I remember what's funny is when she's the guy is attacking her, mm-hmm. who's turning into a werewolf, and you hear outside the porno booth all these like loud growls and screams.
Well, you know, if you've ever been in a porno booth.
Oh, you're... yeah.
Maybe he has once or twice. Joe, there's so many directions we can go in. There's so many things that we have to ask you about Matinee, because since we talked about Burt Gordon, we have to talk about the great William Castle. And it's my personal favorite Joe Dante movie.
Well, I Matinee came to me as a script by a writer named Jericho Stone, who had envisioned it as a movie about people who are lamenting the loss of the movie theater. It's being knocked down and turned into a video store. And it was much more of a fantasy about, you know, they're remembering their visits to the theater where the projectionist was a vampire and the usher was a, you know, a monster. And that just didn't sell. So when we try to reimagine it as a more realistic picture, the idea of coming up with it as a Cuban Missile Crisis 1962 movie seemed a little bit more realistic. And so therefore, the character in the original script, who was a horror movie star, who was making a personal appearance, became a horror movie director who was trying out his new science fiction movie in Key West in 1962. And the whole idea, of course, was that it juxtaposes the real fear that I had. I mean, it's a semi-autobiographical movie for me, because I was the age of the lead kid in 1962, and we did believe that weekend that there would be no Monday and there would be no school and the world would be over. And so there's a lot of realism in that picture. I mean, all of the reenactments of the kind of drills, the duck and cover drills and stuff that we had at the time are very accurate.
And when you approached John Goodman and you said you were going to have to give him an education about Castle, but he didn't need one.
No, I thought that John Goodman, I put together a reel of Castle trailers to show John Goodman. He said, I don't need to see that. I know who he is. And, you know, he's not exactly William Castle, because William Castle didn't make those kind of movies. He made straight horror movies. Sure. He didn't make science fiction movies. And in any case, by 1962, nobody was making giant monster movies. But still, it was close enough to the real story that it does, I think, have a certain authority. And it's a pretty convincing version of how people felt in 1962. I know from my experience, it's very accurate. I didn't live in Key West. I lived in New Jersey, and I never was lucky enough to have a horror movie guy come to my neighborhood. But if that was the case, I think it would have been like this movie.
And since we spoke about Tarantula and them, we should talk about Mant, which was the movie within Matinee.
Half man, half ant, all terror.
It's wonderful. Well, absolutely, you know, wonderful.
We were confronted with two concepts, one of which is make fun of it by making it shitty, and the other one is let's try to do a kind of a realistic version of what this kind of movie was in that era. And so the special effects are kind of state-of-the-art for 1962, and the movie itself looks kind of, you know, with the Kukuloruses and the style of shooting, it looks like a kind of a Columbia B movie. And there's a lot of quotes from actual dialogue from 50s science fiction movies, many of which were by Burt Gordon, where we literally stole the dialogue. I mean, word for word. And that's part of what makes it fun.
Yeah, and the Disney film, too, the shook-up shopping cart is also wonderful.
Well, that's a pretty accurate trend. I mean, who of my generation can't remember the horror of having to sit through movies that was like, holy crow, there's just nothing interesting in this movie. it's like it's from my parents or something.
And you were going to do Godzilla Reborn.
Well, Michael Schlesinger and I were going to do a Godzilla Reborn movie for Sony, and it was sort of a spoof, but then the Toho people, I think, kind of cooled on it, because I think they saw bigger paychecks in the future.
And speaking of other projects, tell us what's happening with A Man with Kaleidoscope Eyes.
Well, The Man with Kaleidoscope Eyes is a movie which has been written by Tim Lucas and Charlie Largent and Michael Almereyda, and it's a movie about Roger Corman making the trip and in 1967 and how it changed him and how the act of taking LSD in order to, you know, be true to the movie, as Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson insisted he do, changed him and changed his view of the world and changed all of our views of what the world was like. And it's a very funny movie and I think really pertinent and interesting. And we have been working on it for these many years, almost a decade. And we still haven't gotten it made, but we have not given up. We're still exploring every avenue, I believe is the phrase.
I hope it happens, for the love of God.
Oh, it happens too.
We find it funny, the two, that Dern, we were talking to Bruce Dern, and he didn't take drugs at all. And
Bruce doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't take drugs. I mean, he is a pure, all he does is run, which I don't think he can do anymore because of his, you know, physical condition. But he's one of those guys who is just into the adrenaline thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you worked with John Carradine.
I worked with John Carradine in The Howling. I tried to get him for Piranha, but he didn't have a high enough TV cue. And the part of the deal of making Piranha was you had to sell it to a network. And so they had to, these people are approved and you can hire them. And so we hired Keenan Wynn instead. But when I worked for John with John on The Howling, he was in a period where he was literally doing anything. I mean, he had ex-wives to support. And, you know, a lot of reasons to do anything that came his way. But I spent so much time talking to him and that I would literally do the slates at the beginnings of the shots so that he could tell me stories while they were adjusting the lights. And then I would click the slate and we'd do the scene. And then I'd do another take to hear the end of the story.
Wow. any you can remember?
Oh, he had stories about everybody. He worked from everybody from Jean Ford to Jean Renoir. I mean, he remembered everything. I mean, he had an incredible memory, and he was just a great him and Slim Pickens was in that movie. I mean, Patrick McNee. I mean, all these great people. I mean, one of the great things about making these movies is that you get to work with people that you had always admired and grew up watching and, you know, always wanted to be able to talk to. And the problem with low-budget movies is there isn't any time to talk to them.
Right. Speaking of Carradine, I found it interesting, a quote you said, you were talking about Carradine and Walter Brennan and people like that, that they would make 200 films, the 300 films, and you said people can't have that kind of career anymore because the business has changed.
It's not possible because, you know, in the studio system, there was a pool of people that you could work from. And the movies were largely made in the same place. And so people had a lot of chance to be seen and discovered and understood. And, you know, a guy who's known to be a drunk can play drunks and he's the guy who plays drunks. And there's another guy who's, you know, blows his top and he's the guy who blows his top and that's his career. But you can't do that anymore because, first of all, there's just not enough continuity. And if you look at the number of TV shows there are currently out that no one can keep track of and that are using up constantly new actors, nobody really has a chance to make that kind of connection. Every so often you get a Walton Goggins or somebody like that who's managed to make a, you know, a big splash in a particularly, you know, well-watched show and then gets a part in a big movie, and then that's a career. But that used to be much easier to do. That used to be much more common than it is now.
And I've heard stories in the studio system, not only the supporting actors, but the stars, since it was all on the same set, would do one scene of a movie and then rush across to the other.
Absolutely. But you know, actors are still doing that. I mean, I just did an episode of Legends of Tomorrow, which is a new show on the CW. And, you know, they're often shooting more than one episode at a time. So actors have to, you know, run around, change clothes, and, you know, learn the scenes, learn the script for another scene. I mean, whether it's a different movie or a different episode, it's still the same, you know, concept. There's just a lot. It's things are done, you know, to save money. I mean, that's why people do stuff. I mean, you know, it's hectic. It's very hectic.
I want to ask you about a couple of these other names, if you have any memories at all, Joe. Slim Pickens, you mentioned. Gilbert's obsessed with Kevin McCarthy. We've talked about him on the podcast a lot.
Oh, Kevin, I work with numerous times. The first time in Piranha, where he played a part that was vacated by Eric Braeden, because Eric Braeden had done a couple of days in a swimming pool playing this part, and he saw how tatty our production was, and he called me up and he said, you know, I just can't do this. This is just not something I can do. And so we had to replace him. And Kevin was in New York, and he apparently walked around Central Park deciding whether or not to do it. But he was friends with Bradford Dillman, who was the star of the movie. And so he said yes. And we got along. And then I had Kevin in the Twilight Zone movie, and I had him in The Howling, and I had him in Inner Space. And we became great friends. And he was one of my favorite actors before I even met him. So and Henry Gibson is another character who is somebody that I always admired. And particularly when I saw The Long Goodbye and I saw how great his character was and how different it was from the laughing image that he had.
He's projecting. Great in Nashville,
you know, too. It was like, oh, well, this is another guy I really like. And the problem with amassing these people is that, you know, you want to put them in every movie, but, you know, there may not be a part for them. You know, you can't. I got to a point where I was reading scripts and I was going, where's the part for Dick Miller? And I started to kick myself in the head. Like, I can't turn down movies just because there's no part for Dick Miller.
Or Kathleen Freeman.
Exactly. And I can't have him playing Kathleen Freeman's part, just have him in the movie. So, you know, but the great thing about it is that you do work with people. I mean, I just did a picture with Anton Yelchin, who is a wonderful actor, and I would love to work with him again. And so you get all these people, you know, that you've worked with, and they become part of your stock company. I mean, look at Ingmar Bergman, look at John Ford, look at Preston Sturges. You see the same faces over and over and over. It's not just because they're good. It's because they're copacetic. They're people that you can work with.
Oh, we love Picardo, by the way. Speaking of the Joe Dante stock company.
Oh, yes.
You know, Bob is wonderful. And you know, he's his agent. He once called me and said, you know, my agent says I can't work for you anymore because you keep asking me to work for scale. Because, you know, when you do these movies and TV shows, and they get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And it's like, well, you know, and they give the stars more and more money. So there's less and less money for the supporting people. And well, call your friends, have them come in and help you. And it's sort of like, well, geez, you know, how often can you do that?
Yeah. What about, we won't keep you, but as we start to wrap this up, what about Brother Theodore? We loved him.
Brother Theodore, I had been seeing in ads in the Village Voice when I was going to college about, you know, his one-man show. And I actually attended one of them in New York.
At the 13th Street Theater?
Exactly.
It was there forever.
I know. And he was unique, to say the least. And when it came time to cast this Klopek character in The Burbs, we saw a lot of really interesting people. We saw Timothy Carey, who is, you know, notoriously known to have tied up Otto Preminger in a room to try to get a part. And Tim Curry was great, and he actually he pursued me for a while. He would like show up because he was looking for this part of me. But there was nobody like Brother Theodore. I mean, he was more than a little deaf, and so you would have to. I remember Carrie Fisher like doing her lines at, you know, 87 decibels just to get in his cue. He was one of a kind. He was just amazing. And he was such a sweet guy. And because he was elderly, there was a young guy who was assigned to be his sort of minder and, you know, make sure he had everything he wanted. So I didn't really get to talk to him as much as I would have liked to. But as in most movies, there were reshoots, you know, there's always reshoots on movies. And one movie, I refused to shoot the ending because I told them, I know you're going to redo it. So why don't we just not do the ending and we'll just preview it and then we'll go shoot the real ending. And in this case, he came back to do some real endings. And he and Corey Feldman had an interesting dynamic. But I really loved working with this guy. And I was very sorry to hear of his passing.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of meeting him at the 13th Street Theater a couple of times. Did you ever meet him, Gil?
Brother
Theodore?
There's a documentary that I participated in, which I don't know if it was ever finished, about him.
His stage show was terrifying. He would just flashlight under his chin and underlight himself and just scream at the audience. And
but it was so funny because he was in person. He was such a quiet, sweet guy.
He was. He was gentle.
And you do a website series called Trailers from Hell.
A wonderful series.
Well, Trailers from Hell came from the fact that I started making trailers for Corman, and I was a big trailer fan, and I collected 35 millimeter trailers, and I had this huge, you know, warehouse of trailers, and I thought nobody's seeing them. In the old days in LA, when I first came out in the 70s, there were theaters where you could just, film buffs could bring reels of trailers, and at midnight they would open it up for free and everybody would sit and watch 3 hours of trailers and get stoned, and it was great. But those days were long gone, and it was sort of like, well, how are people going to see these? So I thought, well, maybe I could put them up on the internet. And then I thought, well, but anybody can do that. Why don't I do a couple of commentaries? So I picked some trailers and for some horror movies, and I did some commentaries for them, and I put them up on the internet, and to no particular interest on the part of anybody except some friends of mine who said, well, I have a couple of pictures I'd like to talk about. And so it gradually grew. People like, you know, John Landis and Edgar Wright and Guillermo del Toro and all these people who are friends of mine said, well, you know, I have these movies I'd like to talk about. And it's now grown over 7 years to over 1,000 trailers with commentaries by all these different filmmakers. And we basically tried to limit it to people who are actually filmmakers and you know, not academics and not critics, people who actually work in the business. And so we've got writers and makeup people and all sorts of people. And the great thing about the site is that we have three different trailers every week. And the great thing about the site is when people come up to me and say, I saw this movie talked about on your site, and I went and I rented it, and I really liked it. And I like this director, or I like this actor or writer or whatever, and I want to see more movies by them. And it makes me feel sort of like I'm giving back, because there's so much to see these days. There's so many ways for people to, you know, spend their time, as opposed to when I was a kid, where there was like literally radio, television, movies, and sports. You know, and that was it.
And your family didn't get a television until late.
We didn't get a television until the late, early 50s. I used to have to go to other people's houses to watch Disneyland, you know. But now everything is available. If you can, but somebody's got to say, well, here's something you should see. Here's something that I should call your attention to. And that's the great thing about the show. I mean, we don't make any money on it, obviously, but it's just makes me feel like, you know, it's something that's worthwhile.
Well, we can't endorse it enough. We want to tell our listeners that you've got to check out Trailers from Hell. It's you, John Landis, John Sayles, your old buddy Alan Arkush, Rick Baker, Larry Karaszewski, who we had on the show. They're not only commentaries for, you know, B-movies, fun B-movies like Robot Monster and Brooklyn Gorilla, which we talked about, but also good films like Wells the Stranger and The Innocents. And
also new movies. We do new movies. And Brian Churchill Smith tries to do lots of new movies. He did Mad Max. I mean, you know, the new Mad Max movie. We try to, you know, be wide-ranging, but it's basically, you know, the people choose their own movies to tell.
Gilbert,
if we find a trailer for it, great. If we can't find a trailer, then they can't do it.
I remember watching Disney's World of Color in black and white. And you'd see all these lines and explosions. And I'd watch it and go, I don't understand what's so impressive about this.
It was to get you to buy a color TV.
Right. And Joe, you have a nice story about that, about not being able to see Disney. And
well, I was, you know, we didn't get a TV. I had polio when I was a kid, and we didn't have a TV. But the Disneyland show was on, and I was a huge Disney freak. I mean, like most people in my generation, he was like God. And so I remember being carried in a blanket across the street to see the Disneyland TV show at my friend Randy Crawford's house, because they had a TV.
Wow. Just knock on the door.
Like weeping?
Say it again, Joe. I'm sorry.
It's such a poignant story. I can't believe you're not weeping.
No.
I stopped saying the word fuck for 3 seconds, so that...
That's the virtue of a podcast. You can say whatever you want.
Yes.
I have to say, we were watching Trailers from Hell before we called you, and I dare say, this is how educational the site is, I think Gilbert saw a Bela Lugosi, George Zucco movie that he wasn't familiar with.
Yes.
And that's saying something.
Must be scared to death, right?
Scared to death.
Oh, right. Yes.
It was one of Bela's few color movies.
I remember with Scared to Death, I just remember seeing photos of him with a midget.
And so the scenes with him and the midget are great. And by the way, we don't call them midgets anymore.
You're not the first guest to correct him on that.
And you did one on Bride of the Gorilla.
Yes, Bride of the Gorilla, which is and John Landis did Bride and the Beast, which was written by Ed Wood, in which the heroine wears an Angora sweater through the entire picture.
Oh, right? Yes,
there's some good Chaney pictures on your page.
Oh yeah, no, I try to get to the movies we really care about. Other people do the Oscar winners.
It's a great site. So I just want to tell our fans, Trailers from Hell. I mean, you will lose days. I lost hours and hours on that site,
good.
Joe.
That's what it's for. Trailersfromhell.com.
It's wonderful.
And also on
YouTube.
And one of my favorite.
You like it better when you watch it on our site.
One of my favorite movies you talked about on there, The Tingler.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, who can? I mean, have you ever seen The Tingler actually with the seat buzzers?
No.
No, in Percepto?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the great thing about the seat buzzers, and we did this at matinee, was that they weren't in every seat. They were like in every third or fourth seat, so that when you were sitting in the row, all of a sudden the guy one person over was like freaking out, and you didn't know why. I mean, it was really clever and also saved money.
And that's the one where. The Tingler gets loose in a movie theater, and the whole movie goes black, and Vincent Price is screaming, "Scream, scream for your lives."
Exactly. That's
he did that for Victoria Price, Joe. She was very.
And there's a similar scene in Gremlins 2 where the film breaks and the Gremlins take over.
Oh, yes. We're going to have to get William Castle's daughter on the show too.
You should. She's really nice.
Yeah,
and very very smart and articulate. And Victoria also is a person to be great to have.
We had Victoria.
Oh, did you?
We had Ron Chaney.
Oh, good.
And we had Sarah Karloff. I mean,
those are all the horror Hollywood horror museum people.
We had Janet Ann Gallo. Who was the little...
God, is she still alive?
You're not going to stump him. He knows who it is. just as he was starting to explain who it was, I said, no,
how old is she?
Joe's going to know who that is.
You're like the only person who I how say that she? Name to, it doesn't say
well,
who.
Well, if she was 5 or 6 in 1942,
yeah,
she would be what?
She's not that old. She's in her 70s.
Wow.
And yeah. alert.
Well, she's actually only a little older than I am, I'm sad to say.
She was thrilled to hear from us, Joe.
I'll bet.
And she said how she, as a little girl, would play hide-and-go-seek with Lon Chaney and Bela Lugosi.
Oh, there you go. How many people can say that?
Right. And I think Lon Chaney wanted to adopt her.
I heard that. Yeah. He was so taken with her. But did she not have parents?
She had her father was still alive, and yeah. he said, no, I'm her father.
I'm yeah. not surprised.
But I think she kind of felt bad that she wasn't adopted by Chaney because she liked him.
Yeah.
Joe, you have no idea how excited and thrilled he is that you knew who Janet Ann Gallo was without an explanation.
Well, this is a pretty esoteric show.
Yeah. The one we try to do every week.
I can see.
Well, we thank you. It was a thrill.
And you're like one of those people we could have spent another 5 hours talking
well,
to.
Well, thank God you didn't.
But we're going to make you come back sometime if you're ever in New York, and we'll talk about Lionel Atwill's sex scandal and the hideous sun demon.
Well, I don't have any firsthand information about
it. No, that's okay. We didn't get to talk about Shock Theater or all this other cool
and
stuff.
Do you have
it next time?
Do you have any other things you want to plug before we wrap up?
Do I want to plug anything else?
You want to tell us about the Hollywood Horror Museum?
Well, you know, a bunch of us who are in the genre have gotten together, including some of the offspring of the stars, it's a genre that doesn't really get a lot of respect. And since the passing of Forrest J. Ackerman, who had a lot of stuff in his house, and you know Bob Burns, who was the current holder of a bunch of props, I think there's a feeling that there needs to be some permanent place for this stuff to be exhibited. And I think the people behind this idea want to take it on the road initially and get some more publicity for it, and then apparently ensconce it as part of either the current Academy plans for a museum or maybe something on its own. I think all that's kind of up in the air, but it's definitely something that's in the air, and I think worth the effort because you know this stuff doesn't last forever.
Yeah, it's important to do it. I mean, we're doing this show, you know, in our small way to try to make people aware of Burt Gordon and Janet Ann Gallo.
One thing you said, and it's funny because I've experienced it, is people going, I had no idea who you were interviewing. I had no idea who you were talking about, but I've been looking up all the names now and looking up these films.
Well, that's sort of what the whole thing's about. I mean,
yeah, we're trying.
Look, who are we except our past? I mean, our past has made us who we are, and there's so many people I think who I meet who become interested in things that they didn't know existed.
Well, it's fun when we get the actor James Caron.
Sure.
And we got James is an old friend of Gilbert's, and we talked to him, and we just got mail from people saying, I knew the face, I didn't know his name, I'm so thankful to you guys for introducing me. It makes us feel good, too, to introduce these people to.
The important thing is to appreciate these people while they're still with us.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
And it's funny because I remember when they used to have shows like Fantasy Island and Murder, She Wrote.
Love Boat.
Love Boat, yeah. And you'd see these people who you thought were dead popping up, and you go, wow, they're as good as they ever were.
Mm-hmm.
But they're forgotten about.
That's true. It's true. But, you know, the one silver lining might be that there's so much stuff being made now. There's so many TV shows, maybe too many, some have said, that there may be more opportunities for people to be able to be employed than there were.
Well,
okay. I'm going to start wrapping up now.
Let this man get on with his life.
Yes.
But there is so many more things we could talk about with you, Joe. It was fun.
Okay. Well, just invite me back.
We will.
I'm Gilbert Gottfried. This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast, with my co-host Frank Santopadre. Thank you, Joe Dante.
Thank you, Joe. We're going to send you a monkey.
Thanks.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Bye.